The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to do anything I can. Well, to do it then. Country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Okay, so later on, Harry Ardler is going to join us, give us the lowdown on working under Eddie Howe. Seems Eddie's about to be named Celtic manager next 24, 48 hours. In the meantime, Dan McDonnell of the Irish Independent is with us. Hiya, Dan.
Hi, Joe. How are things? So this time last week, I'm sorry, just before I came on the football show, Waterford got rid of their manager, and this week they've hired one around 10 minutes before the show. So I apologise if I haven't been watching Chelsea-Arsenal, but they've announced Mark Bertram as their new manager. Around 15 minutes ago. So, sorry about that.
That's fine.
I just like to get it in there, you know, just like if I seem a bit frazzled and distracted in the early minutes, it's just the joys of breaking news at the late minute in the day. But anyway.
I know all about it. Will Waterford fans be happy with this appointment?
They'll be as ever. They'll be slightly perplexed by it. Like, it's a completely left field appointment. I actually listened to a podcast with Mark Bertram, funnily enough, last week. There's this podcast called... Under the Cosh. It's basically a UK podcast with these ex-lower league footballers, John Parkin and Chris Brown, interviewing teammates, you know, or not teammates, just interviewing guys generally from the lower leagues, you know, from their era of football. And I'd have to say, during like lockdown and stuff, it's been very entertaining. And just by coincidence, Mark Bertram was on it last week. I don't know if people might remember him. He was a player who played for QPR, who used to have this mohawk for a couple of years. He had this sort of mad haircut. So definitely people listening to this who followed the Championship will know exactly who I'm talking about. But he's a 42-year-old now, hasn't managed at senior level before, similar to Kevin Sheedy, but he has been assistant manager. Bit of a legend at QPR. Actually spoke in that podcast at starting his career under Mick McCarthy at Millwall in the 90s as a trainee, and that's a very entertaining story. So he is very much of the English football scene, and I suppose Lee Power, the Waterford owner, has appointed people from that network, you know, John Sheridan and Sheedy and Mike Newell and that type of appointment. And I suppose it's not one of those, but bit of head scratching for people, but a colourful character, definitely. He'll be an entertaining interview, that's for sure.
Okay. Never dull. So last night, the inevitable happened. Manchester City crowned Premier League champions. Leicester beat Manchester United at Old Trafford. United again in action, of course, tomorrow against Liverpool. Jurgen Klopp said he didn't really blame Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He would have done pretty much the same thing. It's those pesky TV people, so he's sticking to his team. For Man City, Dan, in December, this was not looking good. You remember, and Guardiola hadn't signed a contract, and there was a sense that maybe the momentum had been lost and just everybody was a bit burned out and it had run its course. And suddenly he signed a new contract, and from December, after that 1-1 draw at West Brom where they were in sixth and where Liverpool had picked up some form and looked like they were threatening maybe to kick on, City had 15 straight wins and have won this league very convincingly. So for Pep Guardiola, he is now number two on the list of league medals across Europe's top five leagues. He has overtaken Giovanni Trapattoni's 8. He's behind Alex Ferguson. Ferguson's on 13. You wouldn't back Pep to win 5 more and get to 14 and beat Ferguson's record. As for the Man City project, this moves them level with Aston Villa in terms of the most successful teams in English football when it comes to league wins. Their 7th title. This puts level with Villa. They're joint 5th, yeah. So their previous two league wins, 1937 and 1968, I think. It's either 68 or 63, but the 60s. And then, of course, Abu Dhabi project starts 2012 onwards. 5 since 2012. 3 in the last 4 years for Pep. They've pretty much owned the 2010s.
Yeah, no, they have. Like they went through a phase, I suppose, where they were not necessarily the most consistent, you know, that they'd have a good year and a bad year. And I suppose, listen, in a sense, I mean, last year was a bad year for them, and they've responded to it. But I mean, yeah, it is certainly, you kind of wonder, yeah, like, you know, how many league wins do you need for it to become your era? You know, like in the sense that I suppose we will look back in the 2010s as their time, I guess. You know, I don't know. Like, I mean, there's obviously been, you know, Chelsea winning the Champions League and other stories across it. But, like, have they owned it in the same way that, say, you know, Liverpool of the 80s and Manchester United of, I suppose, the 90s? I guess so, you know. I mean, I guess it's just because they're, sometimes their bad years were very bad by their standards, that it wasn't like a sustained dominance. It was more, you know, they've had so many different managers. Until obviously Pep has come along, but, you know, with Mancini and Pellegrini, that it wasn't, it was a different, maybe a very modern type of, you know, dominant era. Whereas you think of previous ones, it's like, you know, Fergie and an overarching figure.
Yeah.
Where it's more actually just their stunning wealth. If we're, I mean, listen, that's what's brought them there. You know, so it's no surprise that trophies follow with it. But maybe actually now, like, if they can add the Champions League to it, it becomes a bit more of a, you know, a definitive moment. I mean, this one, like, listen, the Aguero moment will always be theirs, you know, like, that is one of the most famous moments of recent memories. This season, it feels, hasn't had that type of moment at all. I mean, it'll be remembered as a season because it was an entire season behind closed doors, ultimately. And it sort of feels like it's gone on forever. You're going back to December there when we were talking about them. People were talking about them being a busted flush. And yeah, there was a lot of praise around that time, even for their conditioning and how they'd managed it to peak when other clubs were struggling. But, I mean, listen, that comes back to squad depth as well, too.
There's not much romance about it. I mean, money is always important in football, of course, but it's particularly prevalent now at the moment. And with this project, from Sheikh Mansour's perspective, there is a degree of sports washing here. There was no doubt this feeds into Abu Dhabi's business interests, their portfolio and growing empire, all part of this. And I'm sure as well, if you're that rich, it's fun to have a plaything, and owning a football club is a lot of fun. What you would say is that it has the project, and again, it's deliberately an unromantic word for it all, they have carried it out with a real degree of clarity. I think as these things go, it can get very muddled when there's so much money and so many voices. But really, they identified pretty early on that Pep Guardiola is the best manager in the world. So let's get him. Let's build an infrastructure to facilitate his arrival. Money alone is not going to impress Pep. We don't have much tradition here. So we need to be very smart about how we do this. And they got Tiki Begiristain, football director from Barcelona in 2012, I think. Ferran Soriano, I don't know how close he was to Pep, but certainly he was at Barcelona as well when Pep was managing the B team. He came in as CEO, and everything was just built there waiting for his arrival. Manuel Pellegrini was, you know, it was an open secret. He was just keeping the seat warm, and it was, could they get Pep over? And the other thing they did was they gave him the power. Like, that's what was quite impressive as well, in that they identified him as their man and they gave him the power. Like, Joe Hart bombed out effectively before Pep even arrived on Pep's instruction. This guy's just not good enough. And, like, not for a moment did any executive say, well, you know, Pep, he's kind of been really good here and he's pretty popular. Maybe give him a few months. Not a bad shot stopper. It was Pep says it, Pep gets his way, he's gone. Begiristain has his back. Pep's our man. And what a message. What a way to kick off your tenure. I am so, by a distance, more powerful than the dressing room. Best of luck, everybody. Mm. Every player in the dressing room suddenly knew they lived and died by Pep's approval. And John Giles, you know, I mean, it can seem old-fashioned at times when he might talk about how the manager has to be all-powerful if you want to run a club really well. But there is such a kernel of truth in that. And Giles understands dressing room culture and how it works at a base level. And Pep has that. Pep has that power. So in that sense, while there is nothing lovable about the Sheikh Mansour project, there has been a sort of clarity about the way they've gone about their business, which is pretty impressive, I think.
Oh, listen, I mean, they've used their money, I guess, in recent times reasonably well. I mean, like, every team that's won the league, you know, you can point to, listen, everyone's a genius when you win. You know, yeah. Your transfer policy is brilliant when you win.
And they sign Nathan Aki for 40 million and basically not play him. You know,
yeah, and so Ruben Diaz is a
triumph.
The
money's endless.
You know, and listen, but there is no romance. But listen, I didn't find much romance in a lot of the recent title wins. I wasn't necessarily massively romantic about the Liverpool one either. You know, like, it doesn't, as you know, I've discussed this before, I'm not repeating myself, but there is no romance at the moment, you know.
No, it's true.
But where you... Where actually, you know what? The most romantic thing about the City story is probably Foden. to be fair. I think that's probably the poster boy of the Man City story, in that at least in the midst of everything that's happened there, you know, they do have someone who's come through their system and their academy, you know, who is a world-class player, you know, I guess, yeah. You know. And that probably is, they're a good side to watch. Like I've spoken about this before, it's the thing we all grapple with, you know, that, like, you know, high-end football, it can be brilliant to watch, and yet, you know, you look into the clubs and the characters and where the money's coming from, and it's, you know, that drains it. And to me, it does have an impact on your enjoyment, really, in terms of the glory of their victory. But I suppose if you still like football, you like watching good football, and, like, they are a good side to watch. I've said, like, De Bruyne is my favourite player to watch in the Premier League, you know, and Foden is a brilliant story. And if you want to be glass half full and find a, you know, find a good human interest angle that you can buy into, I suppose Foden is probably the one that's the easiest one to latch onto, you know, in terms of their story.
Yeah, that's fair. So Alex Ferguson sat down for an interview with Donald McRae in The Guardian. I think a lot of people have read this at this stage. It's to promote the new documentary made by his son. Initially, yes, he had recorded a bunch of tapes with Ferguson talking about his career from 2016 onwards, and subsequent to Ferguson's brain hemorrhage or aneurysm in 2018, the nature of the documentary changed somewhat for obvious reasons. So I don't know what you made of it. I mean, right from the off, Don McRae sets out some of the terms. For instance, he says, a Ferguson interview is extremely rare and it comes with a stipulation. He will not answer questions about Manchester United today, about the Glazer family, about Ed Woodward, or anything about the aborted European Super League. And I suspect it goes without saying he wasn't going to talk about the BBC documentary or banning them for 7 years as well, etc. So, as ever with Ferguson, control is the theme. Even at 79, doing an interview with Donald McRae, it's like, I'm in control of this.
Yeah, 100%. And, like, you know, people can read the piece. There's obviously an interesting part in it where Donald McRae, like any proper journalist does, still doesn't try and follow the rules. Like, you get these terms, as you know it yourself, you get terms and conditions with stuff, or attempted terms and conditions all the time, and you're still trying to find and work a way around it. And he does try and work around it towards the end of the interview with a question related to the sort of... you know, I think that I don't have it quite in front of me.
But I do.
Oh, great. Go for it then. Yeah.
I referenced the working class socialist values that define him. Did he feel proud of the supporters who came out in vehement unity against the European Super League and the way in which modern football clubs are now owned? Ferguson is about to answer when Jason, that's his son, when Jason puts a hand on his arm. I don't think we should go into that, he says.
Well, you know, that's it's funny, like, because obviously there's a sense in the interview that you see more vulnerability in Ferguson, because clearly he talks about look, he's been through a sort of a very harrowing dice with death, and, you know, he speaks about how, like, you know, he had to learn to do things again. He was worried about losing his memory, and actually you get the sense from that little anecdote, and it's well written by Donald McRae, that it is the son who's almost more protective. Now obviously he's probably protective from a I would assume a business point of view as well too. Like, the son's involved with the documentary, and they probably don't want their documentary, you know, to be overshadowed by Ferguson's take on this.
Yeah.
You know, like, because that obviously Ferguson comments on that in any way, it becomes a story. I mean, some would say there's no such thing as bad publicity, you know, in terms of pushing it, but I think it's obviously more calculated.
Well, unless he's conscious that Ferguson is still on the payroll at Old Trafford, let's not say anything here.
And he can't really win, like, you know, what is some of his back catalogue of comments about the Glazers, really? Like, what can he say now that doesn't leave yourself open to scrutiny and accusations of hypocrisy of some description?
Yeah. Well, it did get me thinking, the interview. Pete, do we have the clip? You can check there. There should be a clip there. Shout out to JP. There should be an Alex Ferguson clip there from an interview with Jon Snow. The lads should have that. But we'll get to that in one sec. It's quite moving the way he talks about the situation post-2018. So he couldn't speak for 10 days and he was so afraid of losing his memory. He said, that was the big worry for me. It happened after the operation when I lost my voice. That was the most frightening part. I knew I was alive, but on my own. And it's that thought of being on his own in a hospital bed, almost such a tough moment for any human being facing mortality. On my own, I started thinking, I wonder if they're telling me the truth, The operation was a success, but you're in that loneliness. It can be frightening. When I lost my voice, I thought they never told me that this might happen. And that's what seemed to, for him, prompt the fear that I'm going to lose my memory, because they never told me I was going to lose my voice, and that's happened. So where am I going to be with my memory? And he goes on to say, as a manager, I depended on my memory. You see games today where some managers take notes during the match. I never did that. I always depended on my memory. And when I went to the dressing room, that was very powerful for me. I can't understand why a manager would take notes during the game. Put your head down to write and you miss a goal. And Jason, his son, remembers the machines and wires everywhere at Salford Royal. So they'd prepared him for surgery at Macclesfield. And two neurosurgeons called Jason Ferguson over to a side room. Jason Ferguson says, OF. And they said, look, he's 76. He's had a massive bleed on the brain. Just prepare yourself for the worst. There's a 20% chance of him surviving. So it was really that serious.
Mm.
And then almost most touching of all, Donald McRae writes that Ferguson came through the operation, but he still put his head in his hands and said, I hope there's nothing wrong with my memory. There had better be nothing wrong with my memory. And he began scrawling the same word over and over again on a piece of paper. Remember, remember, remember. And there is just such a stunning fragility, if you're our age and you remember Ferguson, Pete Ferguson, the fire and brimstone, to go from that, as we all will eventually, I suppose, is the reason it probably strikes a chord with all of us, to be there after such a life-threatening situation and you're writing down on a piece of paper, remember, 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 and the terror and the loneliness he talks about. I mean, it was all very moving, I thought, in many ways at the top.
Oh, it was. I mean, I know this was a different type of illness, but I suppose Ferguson playing in the era that he did would obviously be aware of a lot of people who in a very different context have struggled with their, you know, with their memory, like, you know, ex-footballers and managers his age, you know, and he's probably close up maybe seeing them struggle and, you know, not want to be, you know, afflicted with something similar, albeit coming from a, you know, a more sudden onset of something. And I mean, listen, it's that vulnerability that, like, I mean, ultimately, you know, everyone ends up that way in some shape or form, no matter how powerful, once they live that long, like however powerful they were, you know, in their lives. And that's obviously, like, you know, so much of his persona was about control, you know, that it was about like being on top of everything. Like you speak to players who used to play for Manchester United, like even sort of Irish lads who didn't make it per se, you know, who were younger lads, and they'd always speak about how Ferguson would walk down the corridor and say hello to everyone by name. You know, he'd go and meet parents and he'd have the personal touch of remembering the parents' name, you know, even though like he's probably meeting hundreds of parents in a year, you know, and he remembers bits about them. And clearly like there's no fluke about that. He obviously probably, you know, made that part of his persona to be so much, you know, on top of those things and to work on that.
I think he prided himself. He prided himself on his memory.
And drew power from it.
Mm.
You know, so if you have that questioned, you know, or you think that you might lose it, I can only imagine how like terrifying it might be. Like, you know, we're obviously going through sort of a long sort of pandemic at the moment where people sort of, you know, go through all sort of different crises and things, you know, that you're breaking from some kind of normality and that can make people uncomfortable. And like, you know, part of Ferguson's thing was obviously being in Mr. in control of everything all of his life.
Mm.
So it's like there's suddenly been a situation where you're powerless effectively.
Yeah.
You know, it really does come through in the piece, and you suspect it's really going to come through in the documentary as well. I mean, it does reference how, you know, he wrote a letter to his wife, Kathy, which it seems like he effectively expresses regret, you know, because one of the things that I think struck him with the illness, as many people do, you know, who work so hard for all their lives and then something happens to them, they almost end up feeling a degree of guilt for not having paid attention to some of that family stuff over the years because they were so in the zone.
Oh, yeah. I think it's, isn't it, in, you know, that palliative care nurse in Australia who wrote the book, The Regrets of the Dying? I think it's, for men in particular, obviously, I'm sure increasingly it will be for women, given we're all working so bloody hard now, but of a certain generation, I think pretty much the number one regret of the males was that they'd worked too much. And so Ferguson had put that to his wife in almost a goodbye letter. So just, I mean, it's pretty interesting. Check it out in The Guardian. It's worth the read. It's not like it's in fairness, Don McRae does try and ask him about the more current situation at the moment, but it's not really a time to dig into a 79-year-old on still recovering from this difficult time in his life. But there's some nice stuff, talked about going off the rails a bit in his youth, and he fell out with his dad, and then scored a hat-trick in a game, and that got them back on track together.
I thought that was interesting, actually. Yeah. I thought that was interesting because Ferguson as a manager always seemed, I don't know if you agree with this, but like he always seemed to be willing to indulge the people who, you know, who didn't always play by the rules. Yeah. Like for all he had his persona of being like, you know, he's a disciplinarian, like he could just about handle Cantona or certain people doing his own thing, or he had guys in his dressing room who liked the night out. He clearly had to stamp it down because they liked it too much at Manchester United, but he always seemed to have a degree of understanding. You know, and clearly, like, yeah, I mean, he spoke about ending up getting arrested himself at one point.
He went out and got drunk and ended up spending the night in jail. But then ultimately, he scored a hat-trick. That got him moved to Rangers, he recounts. There's a beautiful photo of him playing for Rangers. I hadn't seen it before. And he was asked, you know, early on. I think it's a pretty famous story if you've read any of his autobiographies, where the Rangers director asked him if he'd married Cathy in a Catholic church. And
yes.
He wishes he told that director where to go. So it's all there and it's pretty interesting. You know, it got me thinking on the Glazers front. You would love to know what he thinks about it all now. And again, I think most people have come across this clip. It's on YouTube. The full kind of 15 minutes are there on YouTube. But when he released his... certainly a second book. I've lost track of his books at this stage. But one of his books, Jon Snow of Channel 4 interviewed him. I think this is about 2013 territory. So he's pretty much done at United at this stage, I think. Or it's in his last season, but probably done. I'm working off memory there. But it just got me thinking, this interview, of what he would say about the Glazers now. Because what we have here with Jon Snow on Channel 4 in about 2013 is kind of the only time I remember Ferguson being put to the pin of his collar when it came to the Glazers, and really being put on record when it came to the Glazers. Jon Snow, brilliant journalist, wasn't afraid to give Ferguson a hard time. So have a quick listen.
But they're supportive. That's the important thing. I think that you always appreciate people who support you. And they've been very good. And they're very... everything they've asked for, they've delivered. So what can you do? I think it's the right thing to do.
See, it's interesting. You describe yourself as on the left of Labour. And yet you describe them as rampant capitalists.
Isn't that a quote? No, you're wrong there. Get your facts
right. It's not
right.
Their fault that they're rampant capitalists. And they let me do whatever I wanted.
No, I didn't use that word rampant capitalists.
Okay, I'm missing it. Anyway, you describe them as capitalists.
You got that wrong again.
Let's ask that again. But you're content with the Glazers. Yeah. But they are capitalists, and you're certainly on the left of Labour. How do you marry an admiration of raw capitalism with your politics?
Because they've supported the manager, they've supported the club, and all the improvements they've made. You look at the training ground today, that's down to the Glazers. Fantastic training. It's probably the best training ground in Britain. And it gives the club, and I said this last year, maybe it's the best thing we've ever had, is producing the medical centre. It's absolutely fantastic.
But they've also produced a debt, the like of which nobody would want to sleep very easily with. 400 million?
Well, that was 700 million.
Well, it's still a lot.
Yeah, but don't forget, any takeover in business is done with debt.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I mean, he does have a point. The latter point he makes, that any big takeover in business is often done by debt. I mean, it's true. You know, and there is a degree of football here meeting cold, ruthless, big boy business. And it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I guess Jon Snow's point is on the money when he says, well, how does it square up with your left of Labour politics? That's a different conversation.
No, and listen, I think like where Ferguson's met a rod for his back there was like by speaking about his politics previously, you know, and being so, you know, open about it and stuff. But like, I mean, as I said previously, like, you know, The top end of the Premier League now is no place for an avowed socialist to, like, you know...
The Trotskyites are dying out, Dan.
Like, you know, you can be one, but, like, then you can't work there, you know, for allegations of sort of some kind of hypocrisy. And that's the thing. Like, you know, you'll have like, as I said, some very impressive people, you know. Like, I'm a big fan, like, I love listening to Klopp and stuff. Very impressive people, but obviously, you know, the entities they can work for. Like, Pep, you know, like, Pep has been... You know, in terms of his own background, sort of from the Catalan side of things, and at times in his life has spoke very well about that. But then obviously you're working for a petrol state effectively. So like, you know, there's no consistency there at all with that. So but I have to say, like, you know, I think Ferguson's track record on that speaks for itself. It's uncomfortable subject matter. You can see why the Sun doesn't want him to be asked about it, because he can't really win. I think his legacy on it you know, there's that asterisk on his legacy with the whole Rock of Gibraltar thing and the Glazers and how it all came to pass. Yeah. Like it doesn't hang over everything he's done there, but clearly, you know, some people will quite rightly point it out. Oh, the one thing I would say about the interview as well, it's not diminished by the fact that he doesn't really go there, though, because it's interesting. And very complimentary about Steven Gerrard, who he wasn't necessarily, you know, as a player, I think at times, was he not maybe hugely complimentary about Gerrard, or am I remembering things wrong? But certainly as a manager, he's been very impressed by Gerrard in terms of how he's going about things at Rangers. And I thought that was interesting. He's certainly been studying his press conferences and thinks he's very good in terms of how he manages himself. You think he says, you know, a bad press conference can get you fired, you know. And another thing Ferguson always thought about is press stuff. And clearly he thinks Gerrard is going the right way.
Well, it has since emerged post the interview. Gerrard's come out and said that they talk on the phone a bit. So it's an even closer relationship.
I wasn't aware of that, really. Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, that's so. Well, listen, you know, he's not going to be talking to Roy Keane about his managerial career, is he? So, I mean, who do you dial up?
Pretty interesting stuff. A couple of other things going on. There are going to be Richie towel haircuts around Tala. We should mention that.
Yeah, so Richie, well, yeah, I mean, this was sort of known. I did a story on this back in February. He had done a pre-contract announcement, so it's just been confirmed. But it's sort of more insult to injury, I suppose, for the Dundalk people to see. They're going to see pictures of Richie Towle wearing a Shamrock Rovers shirt when, you know, they probably thought he would have been going to them. But he's got a 3.5-year deal at Shamrock Rovers. He's 29. He's coming home for family reasons. You know, he's coming home to sort of settle in Dublin with his family. And I mean, it's. I can understand why he's made the decision that he has. Yeah.
I think the first game he's eligible for is against Dundalk as well, so it just gets better and better.
If we have fans by then, it'd be...
tasty. Yeah. Ryan Johansson declares for Ireland. So people probably vaguely aware of this. He plays at Seville. He was part of the Bayern Munich under-17 and under-19 teams, then moved to Spain, has signed a 6-year deal at Seville. Still only 20. He's playing largely for their B side at this stage. This, I remember, was a complicated one in that he was born and raised in Luxembourg to a Swedish father and an Irish mother, felt an affinity to all three countries. His preference ultimately was to play for Ireland, but then he had to take legal advice because he hadn't been made aware of the consequences for playing for Luxembourg at a certain level before he registered his Irishness. Long story short, that's all a bit boring. It's gone through the relevant committees or legal areas, and he's now eligible and very much declared for Ireland. So Ryan Johansson at Seville, 20 years of age, is going to be available for selection, is he?
Yeah, no, FIFA, basically, you know, you are right, it's a bit dense and sort
of hard. Don't worry about filling us in and all that stuff.
FIFA basically changed the rules, and as a result, he can now play under rules previously he couldn't have. To be honest, I heard you speaking about the news around earlier. Like, I haven't really seen Ryan Johansson play other than sort of clips and snippets. But, you know, he played for Tom Mowen's under-19 side in 2019. And from speaking to people who were at the games he played in and from people who sort of watched him or were at the camp, I think he'd impressed in the camp without necessarily sort of blowing people away. But, like, that there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like, he was coming in for a friendly week. You know, and he's a midfielder. I think, you know, people thought a classic cliche, like, you know, technically, you know, quite good and but didn't necessarily like go around dominating or imposing things. But he's a very young player. You know, come up through that Luxembourg system, that is pretty impressive.
Well, listen, they're a damn good side, Dan, as you know.
As we know. But he still opted to go that way. But I suppose the strongest thing you could say about him is that Sevilla gave him a 6-year deal. Like, that's highly unusual, you know. Like, I mean, so clearly people who know their football, you know, would think that this guy is an investment. And the way they do it in Spain, they farmed him out to their B team and they can take a very patient approach. And listen, sometimes there's an ownership aspect with that and who knows where he'll end up. But, you know, clearly he has a pedigree, having been at Bayern Munich previously and a long contract at Sevilla. And he was pretty keen to play for Ireland. So to answer your question, hopefully, you know, to answer the general question about how good he is, he's had a bit of an injury interrupted season, but hopefully he'll be in with the 21s for a tournament they have at the end of May, start of June. And these days with, you know, COVID, we're actually getting a lot of 21s games on YouTube or sort of, you know, you can watch them. So that would be a good opportunity, hopefully, to see how he's developed and how he is now as a 20-year-old. You can't get carried away. Sometimes we love the idea of an overseas-born player declaring for Ireland, and, like, you know, you can get carried away by the CV, but at the same time, you know, some people seem to regard him quite highly, so I'll be interested to see more of him.
Good. An hour gone by the way at Stamford Bridge, Chelsea 0, Arsenal 1. By the way, Dan, so on at least two occasions when Chelsea have sacked a manager, I have said to you, I'm done with this Chelsea business. They're just the worst of the worst. I mean, it's all petrostates and oligarchs and mercenaries, but Chelsea, I felt, were especially soulless. And I know there's a relative in your world who does not think much of me, in my opinion, and is not happy with me at several junctions. He's listened with disdain, Chelsea fan. I need to eat some humble pie. I need to fess up and say that Chelsea under Tuchel are bloody interesting. I mean, I'm all in on Chelsea, who've just scored, even as I'm complimenting them. They've literally just scored. I mean, that just cements it.
Magic.
Yeah.
Basically, the whole point was, Joe, you spent around a week going on about how Chelsea had no sense of a journey.
Yeah.
Like everyone else in the Premier League, of course, as we've touched on earlier, has an emotional story and journey that they're all on,
My point was with Chelsea that regardless of the manager, they're gone in 18 months. The last manager to do 2 years there was Mourinho. So yeah. I distinctly remember saying to you, fired Lampard. There was something about where Lampard could take them that was kind of interesting, and the kids, and I was into it. And then they got rid of him, and I just thought, no, I just another bilingual European coming in, Thomas Tuchel, grand. I'm just not interested. And Dan, I'm bloody interested. Why is it? Why it's because he's just doing such a good job, and he's so impressive. I think, isn't it?
Yeah, he's he has taken them on. That goal has been disallowed, by the way, for offside.
Okay.
So the journey's a bump in the road.
Yeah.
But like I think it's just that, like I think actually the interesting part of the story is that it was probably a lot of the noise around Lampard going and how the English football aspects of the English football establishment were thinking, who is this guy? You know, you're in the Premier League now, Thomas. You know, you're not in whatever previous league you've been in, which actually is a high end league. And that he's basically proven in a short space of time. Well, no, actually, if you put a really good experienced manager with this group of players, you can make something happen.
Mm.
And I think that's actually why the story, people are probably enjoying it more than your typical Chelsea story.
It's definitely part of it. I mean,
the point was that close relative did text me last week and say, you know, you can tell Joe where to shove his journey now, words to that effect. So clearly, like, your words went on the sort of the virtual dressing room wall.
Oh, they did. I'll have to meet this man for a pint and apologise someday. I love Lampard English thing. I mean, I was interested in Lampard. And it wasn't that I think Tuchel wouldn't be good. It was more just, here's another, yet another, you know, in the long line of Chelsea managers. But he is a cut above a lot of them, I have to say. So it is proven interesting to see where you can take them. You've got to think next season, the way they're going. So look, we'll take a break. Eddie Howe, it seems, is going to be named Celtic manager in the next 24, 48 hours, give or take. Very few players would know him better than Harry Arter. So we're going to talk to Harry next. Back in one sec.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Now, you're welcome, Max. So still Chelsea 0, Arsenal 1, 67 minutes on the clock. Just before we speak to Harry Arter, Dan, the Richard Keogh story is worth us touching on, I think. So Keogh has secured a payout of about €2.6 million from Derby County after winning his long-running compensation claim against them. Effectively, they have paid up his contract. Just to jog people's memories, because I remember the time thinking this was shoddy behaviour on the part of Derby, and rereading the details, I have not forced to rethink on my part, I would have to say. Car crash. This was after a day of team bonding. I mean, why they didn't all have buses and taxis and everything, I'm not sure. But Tom Lawrence was over the drink drive limit. So was Mason Bennett. They both drove off. Bennett stopped his car at a give way line. Lawrence went into the back of him before careering into a lamppost. And they both fled the scene, leaving an unconscious Richard Keogh in the back seat. So Lawrence and Bennett admitted drink driving and failing to stop when they appeared before a Derby magistrate's court and avoided jail sentences, fair enough, and 180 hours unpaid community service and banned from driving for 2 years. Despite their criminal convictions, Derby chose not to sack them, although they did fine them. Both were unhurt in the incident. Richard Keogh, as we know, was not so lucky, out of action for 12 months. So Derby turned around to him and say, yeah, you can stay and see out your contract, but you're going to have to accept a massive pay cut to do so. Now, naturally, Richard Keogh turned around and said, well, I don't agree. I'm absolutely not accepting a pay cut here. And Derby dismissed him. They sacked him on the spot with immediate effect after playing for Derby at that stage for 7 and a bit seasons, 300 plus championship matches. And the disciplinary panel here that this went to said that, you know, absolutely Keogh had not brought the club into disrepute. All of the things they had claimed he had done, you know, gross misconduct, they're absolutely not the case. He was in the back of a car. So they've had to pay up. And, you know, you reread it again, like there was a real sense of if Keogh happened to be a 22-year-old, I would suspect, or Derby might disagree, but they might have stuck by him a bit more.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, I wouldn't be defending really Derby on any aspect of this other than, to be fair, just because you specifically said it, like the club did lay on taxis for the players, but they turned them down and said they were staying on. And I think, like, to be fair, you know, Richard Keogh was wronged in this case, but I, at the same time, still exercised very poor judgment.
Sure.
You know, like he was sort of a senior player, and anyone listening to this who's been affected by any sort of, you know, the consequences of drink driving, like, you know, there was no real on the night, like everyone behaved deplorably. But like what the issue was, and I think you're right in what you say, in that Derby quite cynically, like they had younger players who would rightly or wrongly would be considered assets, you know, who were at the wheel. Richard Keogh doesn't drive, you know, and he was left, I mean, I don't know, like he was left in a situation where, I mean, what if he was seriously injured, you know? Like, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, and he became the fall guy for it. Yes, he was a senior player, and yes, maybe, you know, he should have been telling people to go home, but you run through the details of the case, as you say, and as you lay it out there, you know, it was a sort of a cynical act from Derby, and it's no surprise, really, that this case has ended up the way. And, I mean, like, he did suffer for it. I mean, it did end his Irish career, effectively, that episode. And, you know, there was obviously, you know, he has got back to the championship, in fairness to him, you know, like, so there is something in that. But Derby, it did appear, and certainly it was the opinion that was reached by the people who reached the settlement, that they didn't handle it in the proper manner. And there was a sort of an opportunistic sense to how they were approaching this episode, which I think left a sour taste with a lot of people. I think if they'd thrown the book at Bennett and Lawrence, and they'd just taken a completely zero tolerance approach to this whole episode and said this night was out of order and everyone almost got the equal punishment, well then you listen, they probably still would have lost an employment case, but I think people would have maybe sympathized with their stance more and said, well, they're taking a strong stance on this. But it was very much like Keogh was the fall guy because he was the old guy who was on a good contract. And I think, you know, what's happened is probably, you know, Derby, I would say, probably got what they deserved to some degree. Or certainly that's what the rule of law has decided.
Yeah, and you've put that perfectly, actually. I'm glad you put it the way you did, because absolutely I agree. Like, nobody came out of that night looking great. It was not good behaviour from anyone.
No, you have to be careful about going too far with the, you know, Richard Keogh. And listen, Keogh's meant to be a great fella, and I'm not, but I just think it's just important to not get too carried away. Like that could have been a really serious incident for someone.
No, you know? Absolutely, so agree.
They were
absolutely
lucky to crash into themselves. Yeah, you know.
No, so. Absolutely agree. And so you couldn't condone the night or say, oh, you know, there wasn't. They to some extent, everybody, they weren't the authors of their own downfall or misfortune in certain ways. But the key point you make is that once it's happened, if the club had taken a zero tolerance policy across the board, then you would have said, okay, there is a degree of principle here which you can almost admire. But it's when the two younger ones on lesser money are kept on, and as you said, the older player on the big contract, however many millions saved, gets the sack. That's when it goes, you know. I think was the word you used.
The young lads would have been on decent money too, but like probably Lawrence in particular would have been viewed at that stage as like someone they could sell for a good whack of money, you know?
Yeah, so. Well, they've been found against in the courts anyway. So it would seem Eddie Howe is set to be announced as the new Celtic manager, is what we're hearing. Next 24, 48 hours seems to be the consensus over in the UK media. A player who knows him better than most is on the line now. Harry Arter, how you doing? Good to have you with us, Harry.
Guys, you all right?
Yeah, we're very well. So just looking at the dates here, Eddie Howe was, involved at Bournemouth for a long time, but he was certainly manager from 2012 to 2020. And you had over 200 appearances at the club between 2010 and 2020. So you two have a lot of history. You'd have a real sense of how this guy goes about his business. What were your first impressions of him? And give us a sense of how the manager.
Well, to be honest, the manager and his personality kind of go hand in hand, really. As a person, he's just someone that really wants to and has a desire to help people. That's probably the one thing that struck me most about him, is his passion and his desire to help players, no matter whatever their age, just to improve, become better people and better footballers. And I guess we had a group at Bournemouth where, you know, everyone sort of believed and bought into his philosophy. This is from the football side. And for me, probably taking it for granted when I was there, because from the age of 20 to whatever age before I started working with different managers, you know, his passion and his identity definitely suited me more than I'd ever imagined.
Mm. And he was a very young manager as well. Did you see a change in him as the years progressed?
Well, but not really, no. So I signed there, I met him when the club had just been promoted from League Two, so it probably would have been probably 10 years ago now. And it was funny because I almost felt like it was an interview when I sat down with him. It was asking me about my personal life, what I want to achieve from the game. And my sort of ambitions and my dreams, I guess, were to get into the Premier League. And for someone so young as a manager, you know, it mirrored him in a way. He didn't say that to me, but looking at it now and knowing him as a person, what I was saying to him, what I wanted to achieve as a player, it was probably exactly what he would have been saying to himself about as a manager. So it was definitely a perfect sort of blend. And, you know, to happen for both of us to achieve that at Bournemouth was an incredible, incredible journey. And he hadn't changed. And, you know, I speak to him here and there and he seems exactly the same. I know he's been waiting for a project that he really believes in before he wanted to go back. He's not the sort of personality that would do something half-heartedly. So, you know, if he is to Celtic, which, you know, you guys said, and it looks like it is, you know, they've got a hell of a manager in their hands.
What's he like on the training ground? What's his approach?
He's very, very passionate about, as I said, helping players improve. His coaching is probably what stands out, probably more than anything. He loves to coach. You know, you have some managers that just kind of let their coaches get on with it. But he's kind of an all-rounder, to be honest. He managed the players. He managed, you know, managed Bournemouth from everything, from what I see. Yeah. They've got some great staff there, of course. But he had a real hands-on with everything at that club. And probably why, I guess, he found it so hard to eventually leave Bournemouth, because I feel he took on so much responsibility, and it was his club, I guess, in getting us where we did. Mm. Unfortunately, ended up getting relegated, of course, and very selfishly walked away from the job to probably, in his head, benefit Bournemouth, which, in my eyes at the time, I was just thinking, surely Bournemouth have got to do everything they can to keep him. This is, you can't let him go. That's what I was honestly thinking to myself. And obviously the decision he made has been something that he's had a good year away from football now to probably learn from things that he feels he needs to improve on. As I say, he'll go into Celtic with a desire for sure to improve himself and definitely Celtic, based on what I've watched him this season, for sure.
Harry, can I just come in there? I mean, from the outside, we always see Eddie Howe. He always seems very calm in terms of his, you know, press conferences, appearances, and how he sort of carries himself. And the one thing you just know it's going to be the question about Celtic now. It'll be, well, he's going to come under maybe a different type of scrutiny, like the attention of the Old Firm. People have spoken about that. Maybe in Bournemouth, you were always surprising people to a degree, whether that's right or wrong. Whereas at Celtic, there'll be this instant demand from the start. Like, how do you think, knowing him, that he will cope with maybe that different type of attention that might just come his way now?
Honestly, no, I don't think it will affect him at all. The one thing that I know about Eddie is that he has an identity and a philosophy when it comes to the football side of things. And when it comes to your interviews and things where he handles the media, as you say, so calm, that is just honesty. He's just an honest man, and he will tell you what he sees and what he feels. So I feel he'll definitely stick to that going into Celtic. And with that, he will be able to deal with it because he'll stay completely honest to himself. And I believe he'll be successful. Of course, if he isn't successful, then, as you say, the pressures that he probably didn't face at Bournemouth would definitely be a lot more extreme at Celtic. And it would be something that he'd have to learn to deal with. But the way for... I'm confident that he'll be able to do it, is that I know he'll stay honest to himself. He'll be honest with his players. And as a player, that's all you can ask for. And as fans, really, all you want is your manager to stay true to what he believes and what he says, and hopefully get wins with that.
Mm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch. So in terms of training sessions, Harry, well, you know, some managers would have a reputation for just, you know, doing shape day after day after day to get a team organised. Others want to play football and are very detailed. Others maybe a bit more hands-off, just go out and enjoy yourself. What was his style in terms of how he set you up?
Yeah, he's very, very very detailed in his work. He expects an intensity with everything. And as I say, coming away from Bournemouth, I never knew that wasn't the case at other clubs.
So, right, right.
I just always assumed that training was at an intensity level that I'd had at Bournemouth. I would go to other clubs. You know, Fulham was very, very, very much the same. But other clubs, I'm like, this is just mental compared to what it was and what standard Eddie accepted. He expects players to give their all, give their best at every session, even if it's a little, you know, the little keep balls, the little squares. He wants that done to your best ability, and that's all we are, players to give their best ability. If they don't feel they can give it, he wouldn't want them training. But as I say, with Bournemouth, he had everyone completely bought into that. They bought into wanting to improve. So, yeah, it was a great experience playing under him for sure. And definitely helped me improve to become a better player.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting. There's a nice little Irish contingent at Nottingham Forest between Chris Hughton and Stephen Reid, and Andy Reid, I know, is working with the underage setup there. So how are things going for you? How's the season going?
Difficult. You know, no other word really other than difficult. A lot of stuff that it's hard for me to kind of understand and really work out what's gone wrong. You know, of course, the change of manager for me hasn't worked out. You know, you see players move to clubs, so a manager sign a particular player and then a new manager comes in and that player just isn't for them. And unfortunately for me, that's been the case here at Nottingham Forest. So very frustrating and very, very disappointing. But
yeah,
just learn that's how football can go sometimes.
I see your last game was the FA Cup in January, so you're kicking your heels, I guess. That's the frustration.
Yeah, just not really understanding the situation completely. It's almost a tad confusing from a player perspective wise. I'm looking at it, you know, we didn't really particularly have the best of seasons as a team, and you're kind of just wondering why, just give me a chance sort of thing. But for me, that didn't really happen. The game that I did start under Chris, I was playing as a second striker, as a number 10, and I'm almost, you know, that's not my position. So it was totally frustrating. I think that's the best word for it. And it's one of those, as a player, you don't want to... Chris hasn't spoke about me publicly in a negative way, and I wouldn't want to speak about Chris personally or my situation personally in a negative way.
Mm. No, I understand. Well, listen, understood. Let's catch up over the summer. Maybe there might be a move in the cards or maybe a turnaround in the fortunes, and we'll chat it maybe in a couple of weeks' time. But Harry, thanks so much for joining us this evening. Cheers.
No problem. Cheers, guys.
Paddy Power, as much a part of Irish football as celebrating a home draw.